Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander listeners are warned that the following podcast program may contain stories, names and voices of deceased persons.
This is Outback Out Loud.
People and stories from Outback New South Wales.
The most amazing little town there could ever be. I love it.
I left to come out west and I came out Jillaroo-ing at Warren. And from there, that's where I started my love affair again with the Western Plains, and I've never left Western Plains from there.
It's a great little spot to live.
You know, just everything about Louth I love.
Just home as far as I'm concerned.
Outback Out Loud!
That's what I like.
Welcome to Outback Out Loud.
In this season, we explore stories and life experiences from the most remote centres in New South Wales.
Let's hear from historian Dr. Mary-Ann Jebb about Louth.
Louth is a small town located in far western New South Wales, 80 kilometres north of Bourke. Louth is on the western bank of the Darling River, the Barker, as it's named by the Indigenous owners, the Barkindji people. Neighbouring Nyampa people also travelled to the Darling River and the Louth region for water, food, ceremony and trade. The land and river remain deeply significant to Indigenous people today. The red gum-lined riverbanks of the Darling and the expansive red and black soil plains give the area its distinctive outback character. Life in Louth has always involved adjusting to cycles of drought and flood. The Darling, the great inland river, rises far to the north in Queensland. When heavy rains fall hundreds of kilometres away, the floodwaters can take weeks or even months to reach Louth. Locals often say the river comes down rather than comes up, because floods usually arrive from distant catchments. European explorers Charles Sturt in 1829 and Thomas Mitchell in 1835 recorded their contacts with Indigenous people in the region of Louth and along the Darling River. Both explorers noted that the river was occupied by large groups of Indigenous people who were on the river fishing and living in settlements of bark huts. Mitchell's journals include detailed descriptions of large gatherings of Aboriginal people near present-day Louth and Tilpa, who watched the exploration party. Both explorers recorded instances of tense, close contacts with groups of people, and that Aboriginal men brandished spears and boomerangs, making it obvious they wanted Europeans to stay away. After Mitchell's reports that the country was well watered by the Darling, with grass-covered plains, squatters began moving into Darling River country. Settlement was unauthorised at first, as it was Crown-owned and not officially surveyed. In the 1840s and 1850s, squatters rapidly took up large pastoral runs along the Darling River and its tributaries, driving sheep and cattle into semi-arid country where water was scarce, except for along the river. At first, pastoralists lived in huts and set up camps with their cattle and sheep, but they soon began to build homesteads near the most reliable water holes. Aboriginal people resisted, often fiercely, as European settlement cut across their fishing and waterhole grounds. This was part of the larger story of contact, resistance and frontier conflict between Europeans and Barkindji, Nyampa and other Indigenous peoples along the Darling in the decades after the first explorations. Louth Township was established in 1859 by Irish immigrant Thomas Andrew Matthews, who built a pub and punt or ferry crossing over the Darling that served river travellers, teamsters, Cobb and Co coaches and local pastoralists. He named it after his birthplace in Ireland, County Louth. Louth grew as a river port and service point where wool from surrounding stations was brought in by bullock dray and loaded onto paddle steamers that plied the Darling. The steamers in turn brought supplies upriver, making isolated river settlements like Louth vital nodes in the colonial economy. In the 1860s and 1870s, bush rangers relied on the isolation of the Western Plains and the Darling River to hide and move about. Riverboats were sometimes held up for supplies, and travellers between Bourke, Louth and Tilpa were frequent targets. Today, the region is largely devoted to sheep and cattle grazing, with some small-scale irrigation and cropping. The village itself offers a striking glimpse of outback life. It is quite literally the embodiment of the phrases back of Bourke and beyond the black stump. Visitors can see the historic post office, the restored Shindy's Inn, and the wide Darling River.
My name is Kim Chandler and I've now been at Dunlop Station for 14 years and my parents were cattle and wheat farmers in the Walgett Lightning Ridge area. And so I spent a lot of my early childhood there, about 50 k's out of Walgett. I was the only girl with five brothers and was very much a tomboy, loving the outback life, heading to town for a bit of chewing gum and watch the local fights up and down the main street as you do as a bush kid. Grew up, left home, went away, did a bit of preschool teaching training, did that for many years. And as the only girl, I was never going to inherit a property. So did my own thing for a long time and had my family. And as the kids were getting older and that, we as a family had that yearning to get back on the land. So we'd been out the Louth way a couple of times fishing, as a lot of people do, and liked the area, and all of a sudden this property came up for sale. So the agent, Les Walsh from Bourke, showed us around and gave us a few highlights, and here we are back on the land. So I'm not near any hot bore baths. I was a hot bore baths kid before they were famous, not doing wheat and hot bore baths anymore, but doing a few sheep and a bit of tourism on the Darling River. Alrighty, Dunlop. It was very lovely, but also a bit of a shock. We'd seen the ad in the paper, contacted Les Walsh in Bourke, and out we came for a bit of a look. He showed us all the highlights. He's a very good talker and convinced us that we were going to be very good sheep farmers along the Darling River, and we did like what we saw. So, bit of deduction in amongst 300 locals on the front lawn of the pub. Got this little dream sheep property and 6 weeks later moved in to a very little property for the area and a big mess. Started cleaning it out and found ourselves unpacking a million acre history. So, 14 years later, we're letting people come through and have a look. Still doing some sheep and some goats on a much smaller level than our neighbours, but trying to keep a story alive now. So it was settled in about 1870 by an Irishman. Sir Samuel McCackie had been in Australia for quite some time now. He'd sailed out from Ireland to be a sheep farmer and he started in the Riverina around Leeton, Hay, Narandra, Jerilderie, and had spotted himself a million acres up here. Paid £200 for a million acres in 1870 and built himself a shearing shed to get started. Did quite well for himself as a sheep farmer, with an empire on his death of 15 sheep properties, but had sold it all to so the government couldn't get their hands on it. So it's had many different owners now and we've walked into what's left of the million acres. We've walked into the buildings of the million acres. A lot of the grazing country's been sold off. But it's kind of the setup in somewhat for this area. Almost original, not a lot of changes with all those owners. So trying to keep this what's left of this million acres alive, and people are loving having a look through. There are lots of little buildings left here, but three main ones. The Homestead, 1886. The store building. Most outback properties had their own store for staff to get their supplies to live and work here, and the shearing shed. And that's what I let people explore through when they come and have a look. It just gives you three different aspects of a property out here. Sir Samuel always built his properties backwards. The shearing shed first, that was where he was going to make his money from. So a very large 45 stand blade shearing shed, but was actually the first shed in Australia to go mechanical shears. The shearing shed's actually got the history for Dunlop as the first mechanical shed, but the store and the homestead give you two other different aspects into how people lived out here. The Indigenous people were a lot of the workforce here, and it just shows you the hard work they had to endure, the lifestyle they lived, by letting everybody look through the three buildings. So part of the story I tell is Sir Samuel and the mess that was left behind, and people are coming back and back and enjoying watching the progress that we're making, putting the buildings back together for the Million Acres. They're stone, like the homestead and the store are stone buildings with timber supports throughout. The stone's local. Sir Samuel was in the era of paddle steamers, so there was no way he was going to be able to get all these building materials down on a paddle steamer. It was going to take years. So with a workforce of 500 staff, he had a workforce to actually do all this building for him, milling the timber from along the river and then finding a stony hill and quarry about 2 km west of the house. So using those 500 strong workforce to go and explode it out, chisel it out, he would have been mingling with somebody like a stonemason by now, guiding the men how to put the stone together. So his buildings are unusually made with the stone, but they have stood the test of time. There's hardly any damage or movement to the buildings he's done that way. The tourism part of our place came across as an extra income to put our property back together. We started it in 2018 in the height of the drought as an income that would hopefully get us through the drought, which it did. And now it's an income that we can spend this money back on the maintenance that needs doing on these buildings. Paintwork, fixing beams, putting bits of the shearing shed back together. And people have been really positive. It gets them back right to the roots of this area, how it started with those early and in the 1800s. And they've been really positive. Like, they're enjoying the whole area, visiting all the area and the different farms days, but learning how much of the area started with in the early days. And the three different buildings here really get them into three different aspects. So getting a lot of nice words in people saying they thoroughly enjoyed and things like that, which is nice. It keeps you going, like it boosts your confidence a little bit. And when people enjoy the tour, you know you're almost on the right track. That's been good. It's been great to have the public support.
Let's catch up with the kids at Louth Public School, talking about all their favourite things.
I meet my friends and I have a sleepover. And then we get ice cream after dinner. And then we have a movie night. We go to the park, we have a party. And then we go wild. And then I think that's it.
Go outside and play on the trampoline. And do front flips and back flips and
I'm usually in our backyard doing things like riding and drawing and jumping on the trampoline.
Play with the fluffy, fluffy king. That's my cat.
And what kind of cat is it?
A ragdoll. He's very nice.
And what colour?
Grey white. When I had a toy in my hand, I flipped it over in the air and my boy cat did a flip, front flip.
I like going to school here because it's in a small town. All my friends, very fun and I like learning.
Yep.
Being kind and happy.
While we're still at the school, we catch up with Julie McMaster.
I'm Julie McMaster and I live at Louth, New South Wales, right near, not far from the Queensland border. Very isolated and very dry countryside. Live in a town with about 40 people. There's a lot of properties around the place. I actually come from Treeny near Dubbo. I moved out here about 40 years ago when there was no power or only 2 days a week mail service, and had to travel on roads that were dirt, and I wasn't used to that because I was on bitumen roads where I come from. So it was a bit of a change. And we had 2 kids back then and had to wash by hand, and my husband was a shearer. To wash all his clothes by hand, we had to light the donkey, heat the water up, had the scrubbing boards, we had the tilly lights, and and we didn't have any air conditioning or anything like that when we first came out here. My husband's grandmother had a block here, and then his mum and dad, they moved on, and then his mum and dad decided to move out, and then his dad was shearing around here at the time too, and then the son thought, well, I want to move out there too, and he came out here shearing. That's the first job he did, and he worked on farms and that as well. I didn't mind it because I'd been out before I had the kids, but it just was so hard because, you know, the where you lived and you didn't have much service, like with anything, contacts anywhere. You know, like we're having dirty water out of the river, and a lot of, you know, like you had to heat water up to wash and shower and that. We had a pool shower thing, where a bucket with holes in it, and had to boil the water and put in it out of the copper. Yeah, that was a bit challenging. Yeah, there was lots and lots of things that was different, you know, like you couldn't cool down. You had to get in the river to cool down when it was real hot. It's sort of a vast landscape, like it's a lot further, like, you know, towns are close in that area, Tringy area, but out here, like, you got to travel to go to the shops, and, you know, you got 130 k's one way and 100 the other way, so that's sort of, you know, pretty hard to understand until you start driving roads and rough roads and that type of thing, or to go anywhere, like if you want to go out to, you know, dinner or something, you've got to travel to town, or you've gone to a party, like, yeah, like it's the travelling, mostly travelling, and, you know, if you need to go to doctor's hospital, that's, yeah, like in the towns you can go straight up there, but out here you've got to travel. So we were lucky today, we got the fly doctor service that'll fly in, and they take about an hour to get here, so lucky to have them. They're very vital for the people in the outback. Back when we come out, it was pretty hard because, you know, we were on low income sort of thing. Like, he was doing shearing as well as re-shooting, but, it was pretty hard. Like, you know, and then you have to go to town and get your food, and it costs money, like, and fuel and everything, you know, so found it pretty hard, yeah. I helped Ian go out shooting of a night. I used to get my mother-in-law to look after the kids, and then I started working in the pub way back. It was a long time back when I was working in the pub, and there's been three lots of people, owners, in my time I've worked with them, and I've also been working here at the school since about 2008. So yeah, so I've started here as a Slosso, and then I went on to Witches School and Support, and then I went doing SAM work, secretarial work in the office. I did the GA job outside, general assistant job. Yeah, so I was doing that too. I just love being at the school. My kids come through school here. Like, it's a really good community, and the community and the parents and everything here are so great, and the staff, like, they're unbelievable, and this education here is excellent. Like, it's, you in the cities, kids don't get this sort of you know, atmosphere, and like, they, you know, one-on-one, you know, you can sit down and work with kids that have, you know, learning difficulties, and yeah, and it's they're very close to you. Like, I love the kids here, really do. We have 8, and we also have preschool kids that come in twice a week. If they can get in, they travel a hell of a long way in. They travel from probably 80 k's in, and which that is, you know, like, we appreciate what the parents do that for their kids, because, you know, it's given them, they come in and they socialise with other kids and be around, you know, the staff here, and they learn, you know, like do lots of things, and which they wouldn't, like they got their own teaching out there with a governess or something like that. But it's good for them to get to be with the other kids around the district. You know, just everything about Louth I love. The people out of town, the soil, everything. Just love it out here. Hear the birds, and we get kookaburras come up to our house, and 4 kookaburras come up every day. We feed them a bit there, they come back. And it's just so nice. I get on my clothesline, I go out, peg the clothes out, kookaburras on the clothesline, waiting for me to feed him. And it's just the most beautiful place in the world. It's just, and we all get along here, and help, everyone helps everyone. Happy place, really happy place. Love Louth.
I'm Gary Mooring. I live at Rosehole Station, which is between Louth and Bourke, and we're at the Little Louth Village, which is 100 kilometres southwest of Bourke on the Darling River. At our house, we've been there 56 years and been involved with the community here ever since we come here. It's a great community. They all work together. They don't have any arguments or disagreements. I've been involved with the Chamber of Commerce, race club, cricket club, any sporting events that are on for all those years, and everybody just pulls together, the same group of people organised and all those organisations, but they just pull together and work really hard to achieve something for the community. Born and lived in Bourke for the first 12 years of my life. My parents have always been in the Western Division, and their parents before them. We class the Western Division as being different to other areas because it's semi-arid, and people just need to know how to live here and how to handle it to survive. Yeah, we run sheep and cattle, and we don't farm goats as such, but we have opportunist goat harvesting, and we also have a tourism operation that we've started about 9 years ago. My wife runs that, and she enjoys that. A few years ago, the Darling River Run was the biggest tourism destination in New South Wales. We decided we'd get on board and tap into that, and it's been really successful, and the best part about it is the lovely people that you meet. We have cottages, we have accommodation in basic cottage cabins, or we have apartments, and then we also have basic river camps along the river where they can camp right on the riverbank. The nearest one to them would be 70 metres away. We don't have them side by side. A lot of them love the isolation. Samantha's built some baths right on the riverbank where you have a light up a fire and a heater, and you sit in the bath and put water in, and you're sitting looking straight out over the river. So people love that. And she's also built another one down back off the river, down on the floodplain, where people can do the same thing. It's just got a bottle wall with no roof on it. The bottle's all different colours. The sun shines on in the afternoon when you're in the bath. It just sets it off. She does a lot of bush art. Wire balls and stick balls and stuff that she makes and sells, and she has a little shop where she sells merchandise. But that's tourism side of it. People are always interested to have a look, and always interested to find out what you do and how you do it. And yeah, what we take for granted, because we've just done it and done it for years, they get really intrigued and really interested in how you operate and how you do it, and just how we handle this harsh environment, semi-arid environment with lacks of rain from time to time. It's what's grown in you. You build it into yourself, and you know it's going to happen again. And we're just going through a dry period again now, and we'll wait for the rains and we'll be all up and running again. But we also know that not too far away there'll be another dry period. From 2000 to 2019, other than for about 4 or 5 years, the rest of that time we would have been drought declared. When we're going through these dry times, you work out a scheme where you say, rightio, when I get to this point, if it hasn't rained, I will sell this number of sheep, this the older sheep, and we call them triggers. And then after you sell that lot, you say, rightio, well, if it gets to this point, it doesn't rain again, to conserve what I've got in vegetation and stock feed, we'll pull the trigger and we'll sell this lot. And then you get down to where, okay, If it doesn't rain by this point, we assess it and we start feeding. We then bring in grain and bring in hay and feed our stock, because you need to maintain your core breeders for when it does rain. It comes very expensive, but it's all part of what we do. We manage it. Some people have decided that they're not going to feed anymore. They'll sell everything and buy them back afterwards, because the market's so good at the moment. You can sell stock for good money now, and you know that you put that money aside and you can buy back after the drought. People have gone into carbon farming, and they're able to not stock up so quickly, so they give the country time to recover. So that works really well. Yeah. Carbon farming's where you are paid to not inhibit the growth of native vegetation. They have companies that assess it and say, okay, you sequence this much carbon, and then they sell it for you on the market and gives you a cash flow. So people have been able to just let the country recover without trying to restock it straight away, because they know they've got that cash flow coming in. It's kept a lot of people on the land. It's brought a lot of people, young people, back to the bush, because they can afford to do it. Before that, mum and dad couldn't afford to have the two kids home working or take over and go to the farm. People that have been in the area a long time, they struggle, they do it tough, because they just don't. Like, the next step west of here is desert. So you've got to say, well, we're semi-arid. And we suffer a lot from lack of rain.
Back at the school, the kids talk about all their favourite foods.
It's spaghetti, mince, cheese, tomatoes, and melted cheese. And it's hot. When it's hot, it's good. And it's so slurpy. There's fruits that I love, and ice creams that I love. We cook porridge, we cook on the barbecue, some I really want to cook potato bake with him.
Oh, that would be something you could ask him to do.
One of the main buildings in town is the old post office, where Emma Bode lives with her family.
My name's Emma Bode, and currently we're at the ex-Louth post office, which is now just a home, not a working post office. We have now lived here, Amelia's 8, so we've lived here 6 years, but have lived in the district for the last 21 years myself. My husband's been here his whole life, but yeah, I've only been here 21 years. I grew up on a property exactly halfway between Cobar and Wilcannia, on a property, and then parents moved to educate 4 children, because back then it was very expensive for boarding schools, so moved to Narromine. And as soon as I'd finished my high school years, I was back out this area, Tilpa area, working. So I have been out here pretty much, except for the 7 years of high school, I have been out here pretty much my whole life. Beforehand, I'd actually worked as a rouseabout, had finished working as a rouseabout and put my early childhood degree to use, and went and worked at the Pari Children's Mobile in Wanarri. And in the downtime through the holidays, they don't work. So good friends of mine here needed a hand in the shearing shed. So yeah, went to the shearing sheds, and yeah, that's where Jason was. So yeah, met him in the shearing sheds. Oh, it's a case of just dry humour. It's a case of between the two of us. It's a combination of just, yeah, the dry humour and love of the bush, and yeah. Before I was married, I used to joke I was a Jillaroo of all trades. There's not much I haven't done in the industries out here. I've worked in the sheds and the yards of the sheds. I've been on a motorbike. I've worked in the children's services, I've been a governess, I've helped manage properties, I've worked with cattle, goats, sheep, pretty much anything that's involved in the land, I've tried my hand at it.
And what's the favourite job you've had?
Even though it's a tough one, I'd have to say being a mother. And that's one of the beauties of where I live. I have been able to be able to continue to work, but also raise 4 children at the same time and instill my love of being out here. One thing that my kids made the comment with, when we had COVID and we had the lockdowns, they have a backyard to play in. They could still get out and do things. So that put a perspective for them. It's not realising how big a backyard they actually have, because husband and I manage 5 properties. And it's one of those things that industry didn't stop through COVID, so we could still get out and do things. We weren't stuck in a house, stuck in an apartment sort of thing. The only thing negative of being out here is they don't get the opportunity of sport. I could, if I really wanted to, drive 200k round trip to Bourke or 260k round trip to Cobar for them to involve themselves in sport. But then you've got, if it's rains, you can't get there. It's the weekend, they're already buggered from school. So apart from sport, I don't think my kids miss out on much at all compared to their city counterparts. So I've got two high school children. They do Dubbo School of Distance Education. It is not homeschooling. They do their school at home, but it's not homeschooling. They actually get a program put together by teachers. It's very much changed since when I did it, when we used to get a mail pack sent out. Now they do it all via computer. So 9 o'clock they log on and they do their lessons all face-to-face through Teams and Google Classrooms. And I've got one who's in year 7, so his is a very structured day. He logs on and then he has 2 subjects for the day where he logs on, does both roll call, then he does a maths program, then he does half hour of his own learning where he's prepping himself for the class. Then they have half hour of face-to-face online with their teachers and their other classmates. Then they have a break and then they do another 2 sections of that for the afternoon. Then I've got a son who's in year 9. So his is a little bit different. Logs on for roll call. And then he has structured lessons through the day for his main subjects. So maths, English, science, PDH, PE, geography, and then his 2 other subjects that he does, which he has chosen, and he's currently chosen wood tech and agriculture. But he has a lot more of his own hands-on doing it when he wants to finish off the programs. Some days you think it would be great if they had a mate to bounce ideas off, because as soon as that lesson's sort of shut, they've sort of stuck with mum or dad bouncing ideas. Each term they actually go down to Dubbo for a week camp, a bit like a boarding school in a big hostel, and they camp for a week and they do everything. So yeah, they still get the interaction with their classmates and with their friends sort of thing. So modern day, with everything, technology, everything's at your fingertip. I remember I said to someone, the only time I've ever felt isolated out here is when we don't get a mail run. So that's usually because it's rain, so I'm not going to knock the rain. It's not for everyone. I've got friends that roll their eyes and think, why on earth do you live where you live? But I love it, so I don't find it challenging at all. Yeah, there is so much to see and do in nature, and let alone, everything else that's around the district that you can see. 100% come out and visit small communities. 9 times out of 10, friendly greetings. Yeah, come out and visit. It is an amazing place if you want it to be.
Thanks for listening. To hear more amazing stories from Outback New South Wales, check out the whole Outback Out Loud series, now streaming everywhere.
We acknowledge and celebrate the first Australians on whose traditional lands we meet and work, and whose cultures are among the oldest continuing cultures in human history. Please like, subscribe, rate us and write a review. The Outback Out Loud podcast was designed and produced by Signal Creative. Season 4 of Outback Out Loud has been made by Outback Arts. You can find Outback Arts at outbackarts.com.au or on Facebook and Instagram. This season was made possible with funding support from the Regional Arts Fund. On-ground support this season came from Marnie Vaughan and Andrew Hull. Outback Out Loud Season 4 was researched, consulted, recorded, and edited by Emma Hoy. Thank you to everyone who's been involved over the last 5 years.